Now, let's turn the clock back about, 40 years or so.
And so, in the great tradition of the best and the worst in humanity, meet the Smothers Brothers.
On a raging, blacks and whites still haven't worked it out. Pollution, guns, and poverty surround us. No wonder everybody's dropping out. But we're still here.
Oh yeah, we're still here.
We face the same old problem, but we're still here. That big deep grind is stretching out before us. Sensors lurking in the wing. CBS would like to give us notice. And some of you don't like the things we say. But we're still here.
He's still there and so am I.
You may not think we're funny, but we're still here. Oh, both of us have grown a manly mustache. The blazers that we always wore are gone.
Yes, sir.
Our clean-cut, all-American look is changing. But underneath, we're still old Dick and Tom. But we're still here.
Oh, we're still here. La, 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 la.
You may not recognize us,
but we're still here.
But we're still here.
That is the way the Smothers Brothers started off the third season of their hit CBS variety show. On September 29th, 1968, it is from a box set that came out about a year and a half ago of that entire third season, or rather, I guess they call it the best of the third season of the Smothers Brothers. The liner notes for that DVD set were written by my next guest, David Bianculli, who at the time was kind of working on a project that expanded into a full-size book, which is out now, called Dangerously Funny, the Uncensored Story of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. David, welcome to the Big 550 KTRS.
Thanks a lot for having me. Yeah, the liner notes actually came out of the book and not vice versa. This book took me 15 years to finish. I'm so embarrassed that it took that long.
Wow. Now, they're talking there about we're still here, and they talk about the change in their look and everything. How radical was it for them to even get a third season? I know they didn't get a fourth, but was there a chance they wouldn't be still here?
Not on season three, because they were such a popular show. They were averaging, even at the beginning of the third season, between 30 and 35 million people. And that's American Idol levels now, and almost nothing else. But back then, it was still good enough, you know, for top 20, top 30, sometimes even better than that as episodes spiked up.
So this was unqualifiedly a hit show on television.
Yeah, it was a hit show, and it had become one against everybody's expectations. It was thrown against Bonanza to begin with, and Bonanza was like the American Idol of its day, or the Seinfeld, and nobody expected it to even last, and it succeeded. But these were just two guys that came on in 1967 as folk satirists and clean-cut, you know, American kids, and by the time they were thrown off the air by CBS a couple of years later, they were considered by many to be, you know, radical extremists.
That's right. Now, how did that change occur in those three short years? Was there one event that made Tom, who was really the driving force of the TV show, say, we're going in this direction?
Well, he says it was a gradual thing. And you can even go back to as far as the first season, and you find they did a sketch on censorship written by Elaine May that was censored in its entirety. That didn't help, you know. And then they did a sketch with Simon and Garfunkel and the guest stars, which was about Billy the Kid's birthday. And the whole point of that Western sketch was that it was okay to show violence on TV. You could have Billy the Kid and everybody else be killed, but you couldn't show Billy the Kid making love on television. And they're saying, well, that seems a little strange.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 40 years later, as a TV critic, it still seems strange. But it was just gradual. And then, you know, by season two, they were inviting The Who on and Buffalo Springfield and breaking these things apart, and then they broke the blacklist for Pete Seeger. 17 years he hadn't been allowed on television.
Yeah, I want to talk about that in specific, because we're going to hear a little bit of the song that he performed.
Oh, wonderful.
Waist Deep in the Big Muddy. In fact, let me play a little piece of that, and then you can explain what the song was about and the controversy that led CBS to get their panties in a wad over this.
Okay, go for it.
Here's Pete Seeger.
It was back in 1942. I was a member of a good platoon. We were on maneuvers in Louisiana one night by the light of the moon. The captain told us to ford a river. That's how it all begun. We were knee-deep in the big muddy. The big fool said to push on.
So there's Pete Seeger, who had not appeared on TV, as David says, for 17 years, and then was booked by the Smothers Brothers, and he hadn't appeared on TV because he had been blacklisted. Explain some of the history of that first, and then what happened with the Smothers Brothers and CBS and Pete Seeger.
Well, he was a member of the folk singing group The Weavers, and had attended some rallies and done stuff that the House Un-American Activities Committee at the time linked with communist leanings. And so they came out with a book called Red Channels, a pamphlet that listed supposedly anybody in show business with communist leanings, and those people could not find work. And something as simple as that. And he also, when he was asked to appear before the HUAC committee, he refused. And so non-compliance in those days was the same as sort of ending your career. So from 1950 to 1967, no Pete Seeger on television in primetime. And then he finally gets back on the Smothers Brothers. And he performs this song that we just heard a part of, which is an allegory about LBJ sending people into the big muddy, just deeper and deeper into this morass. And CBS cut the song, wouldn't play it. And then near the end of the second season, because Tom went to the press and complained, and because the national mood about Vietnam changed, he was invited back at the end of the second season to be able to sing that performance, you know, in its entirety, which you now hear. But it was an amazing triumph for Seeger and the Smothers Brothers, and a great song. And if you think about it, you could play that song right now about Afghanistan or 5 years ago about Iraq, and it's the same exact idea.
Well, I'm not going to plant any moral. I'll leave that for yourself. Maybe you're still walking, you're still talking, you'd like to keep your health. But every time I read the paper, them old feelings come on. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on.
The song was originally about a sergeant in World War II who had taken his men into a river, and the water got deeper and deeper and deeper, and first they were knee-deep and then waist-deep, and then eventually it's up to their neck. And as you say, it turned into an allegory on the show for LBJ pushing us further and further into Vietnam. The interesting thing to me about this is, as we talk about Pete Seeger and this fairly blatant criticism of the presidency, that wasn't done on TV in the late 60s, was it?
Nothing was done on TV in the late 60s. In primetime. I mean, you laugh. It's so true. The 60s were, you know, flying nuns and dreamy genies and favorite Martians. You know, the more tense things were in the streets and in real life with presidential candidates getting assassinated and with, you know, all these things happening at the same time, it seemed like, primetime television was just offering escapism quite intentionally. And here was a variety show that was saying, no, we want to talk about the war, we want to talk about the presidency, we want to talk about politics, we want to talk about drugs and sex and rock and roll. You know, the whole generation gap was presented and spanned right there.
The book is called Dangerously Funny, The Uncensored Story of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. David Bianculli, the TV critic who wrote it, will be back with me in just a moment as the John Brown Show continues with Paul Harris on the Big 550 KTRS.
This is the first time we've done Greg's show. We are very happy to be here. We are the Smothers Brothers. I know a lot of people when we walked out here that recognize right away, of course, we're not the original Smothers Brothers. And those boys would have loved to have been here, but they passed away in 1969.
That is Tom and Dick Smothers appearing on The Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson, not in 1969 or 1979 or 1989, but within the last year or so. And a couple of years ago, I got a chance to see them out at the Family Arena in St. Charles doing their terrific stand-up act, and they are still funny, and Tommy still does the yo-yo man. And this year marks the 40th anniversary of them being fired by the Columbia Broadcasting System. CBS canceled their show, kind of yanked it out from under them. We're talking about it with David Bianculli, who's written a book about that show called Dangerously Funny, The Uncensored Story of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. David, did CBS consider the Smothers Brothers dangerous?
Definitely, and more of an annoyance maybe than danger, truly. But what was happening in 69 is that anywhere that the executives went or the ad directors went or anybody associated with the network went, they would get complaints from their peers about what the Smothers Brothers were doing during that hour on Sunday night on CBS, and it got to be a headache. But, you know, the ratings were high enough that they were putting up with that headache, but eventually there was just one rule that CBS had set up about delivering shows in time so that affiliates could approve them in advance, and they didn't make that deadline.
Was that an unusual thing for a network to say to a producer?
Unprecedented. The Smothers Brothers was the first show to be screened in advance for all affiliates in a network. That whole system that is in place for all networks now began with the Smothers Brothers. And they never signed a contract agreeing to it, but were just sort of told. So years later, they took CBS to court, and they actually won the lawsuit. But as you say, you know, they were fired. They had their platform taken away, and they never quite got their career back again. Although I've seen them very recently, and they really are still good live. And next year, this is so hard to believe, is their 50th anniversary as a duo performing as the Smothers Brothers.
Wow. That's something you don't see a lot of acts doing, 50 years and still working. Although, you know, the career is still going on, but when you have the rug pulled out from you the way CBS did it to the Smothers Brothers, that hurt them a lot. What did that do to their club work or their comedy concert work or Vegas bookings, which I'm assuming they were doing at the time?
Oh, yeah. Tom says they were pretty much dead in the water for about 4 or 5 years. They were consumed with the lawsuit, and then because since they had sued CBS, when you sue an employer, your next employer is not really too happy about the prospect of employing you.
Yeah.
So they had to work back through, like, doing dinner theater and all sorts of stuff and just do a slow road. But, you know, they had a megaphone. They had a platform, you know, in the late 60s when they were needed the most. And I always just wonder what would happen if they'd had a couple more years. But their legacy is still felt on TV. If people today, young people, are wondering why we're talking about them, it's because Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert and Bill Maher and Saturday Night Live are all carrying on that spirit, but nobody's doing it in primetime broadcast TV.
We've referred to Tom as the driving force on this show. Expand on that a little bit, if you would.
He was the one that asked for creative control, and Dick was much more, his brother was much more laid back. But Tom was the one who wanted to help book the guests and look for new talent all the time and push it so that his show could be different visually in terms of direction and different in terms of content, you know, wanted to say something, wanted it to be a worthwhile, though entertaining hour.
And Dick kind of just went along with it? Did he mind that?
No, Dick actually was in agreement with it, but Dick had so much else going on with his life at the time. He would actually go off and race cars down in Sebring and Daytona. So, you know, he had a pretty full life. So he would come in, do what was required of the show, and then leave. Tom was there all the time, thinking about it all the time.
So name some names for me, David. Who were their biggest obstacles at CBS? And did that problem with the network go all the way to the top?
Well, actually, the very, very top would be Bill Paley, and then beneath him, Frank Stanton. And they actually were not the levels where they hit the biggest resistance. They would step in from time to time because every once in a while, President Johnson would call up Bill Paley and say, hey, I don't like what they're doing to me on the show. And then Bill Paley would get involved. But that didn't hurt the show so much. But on the levels of programs and practices was where they kept butting heads. And then near the end, they got a new network president who was a real no-nonsense guy, and that didn't help either.
You mentioned LBJ complaining to the network about them, and yet on the last show of that third season, the last show they would ever do,
right.
Tom read a letter of support from LBJ.
Yeah, and it's a sort of thing that you really would hope even celebrities would get, you know, something about saying, you know, if we ever lose our sense of humor, then we're really in trouble. And he said, if ever there was an Emmy awarded for graciousness, it should go to you. And that was because the brothers had sort of written him a letter. Once he had stepped down and said that he wouldn't run for re-election, Tom sent him a letter saying how much he felt for him at that moment and was impressed by that speech. So near the end, you know, he had a pretty good relationship with President Johnson, but then in comes President Nixon.
Yeah. The letter from President Johnson, which you have in the book, includes this paragraph. It is, and this is from the President of the United States to Tom and Dick Smothers. It is part of the price of leadership of this great and free nation to be the target of clever satirists. You've given the gift of laughter to our people. May we never grow so somber or self-important that we fail to appreciate the humor in our lives. Now, I don't know whether Johnson wrote that himself. I don't know if you do either. But that's still a pretty nice sentiment to have from a guy who was being attacked by these guys on a regular basis.
Yeah, and it looks like it's just a two or three paragraph little tossed off note thing. It does look like it was actually written by Johnson. And I mean, what politician would have the objectivity to step outside himself or herself and do that today?
It's a great point, great point. We're talking with David Bianculli, whose book is called Dangerously Funny, The Uncensored Story of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, a terrific read about the history of these two guys and the work they did on television. He also did the liner notes for the third season of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, a four-DVD set. Why'd they come out with season three before one and two, David?
Well, that's just Tom. He said, if they, you know, season one was the tamest. They got more radical each year. Season three was the one where they got fired, the one everybody wanted to see. He said, let's do season three first because it's the most potent one. And then if the sales are so bad that we don't come out with two and one, at least we've gotten the most important stuff out. But if they do well, then you're almost forcing the video company to come out with two and one.
And are they coming out with two and one?
Two is out, and I'm awaiting the call to write the liner notes for one.
All right, when we come back, I want to talk to you about their connection with the world of rock and roll, in particular the biggest band in the world of rock and roll at that time, and some of the stars-to-be that were a big part of the beginning of the Smothers Brothers television experience. David Bianculli's book is Dangerously Funny, The Uncensored Story of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS. This is the Big 550 KTRS, Paul Harris filling in for John Brown, and talking with David Bianculli, veteran TV critic, who's online in his blog, tvworthwatching.com. He's also been working on a Smothers Brothers book for years, and it's finally out now. It's called Dangerously Funny, The Uncensored Story of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. We're about to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Smothers Brothers as a comedy duo. This year was the 40th anniversary of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour being canceled and the brothers being fired by CBS. And coincidentally, this year also marks the 20th anniversary of a show called The Simpsons, which included this little Smothers Brothers bit.
Boy, the cabbage down, boys, turn that hook kick round. Only song I ever did sing, boy, the cabbage down.
Why'd you stop?
I just wanted to say something.
What?
Dick?
Yes?
You're my brother, and I love you.
Well, I love you too, Tom. Thank you very much. But if you hadn't fought CBS, they would never have fired us from our show.
They didn't fire us, Dick.
They didn't?
We quit.
We did not quit. They fired us.
You were fired.
They fired us from the show.
No, they fired you. They didn't fire me.
Why wouldn't they fire you?
Because they can't fire
the yo-yo master.
And here, is shoot the moon. I'm so cool.
Now look what you've done. Bart was having a perfectly nice dream about brothers, and you ruined it.
Yeah? Well,
boil that cabbage. Boil, 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 boil it down.
Nice little cross-cultural reference there with the Smothers Brothers and the Simpsons. Have any idea who asked them to do that, David?
It was one of the writers. I was interviewing Matt Groening for the book because I knew that he liked The Simpsons, and so I interviewed him about their influence on him. And halfway through the interview, this is about a year and a half ago, he says, "Oh, by the way," he said, "I didn't set this up, but we've got them scheduled to come in and do a recording for a show about Bart wanting brothers, and they're going to be here in a little while, you know, in a few weeks." And so it was sort of serendipitous, but the if you look at the people who are influenced by the Smothers Brothers, and I talked to a lot of them in the book, including, you know, Bill Maher and Matt Groening, and there's a quote from Jon Stewart and all this stuff going on. David E. Kelly was absolutely loved them. He's the guy who did Boston Legal and Ally McBeal. You know, that people who try to slip things into TV, I think they may have gotten it from the Smothers Brothers.
Let's talk about the rock and roll connection. These guys were putting acts on TV that might have gotten a little bit of exposure on the Ed Sullivan Show, but they were becoming the biggest groups in the world. The Who had that classic appearance that was shown in the documentary, The Kids Are All Right, where they show up on the Smothers Brothers and at the end blow up the equipment, and it's so loud that Pete Townsend still has hearing problems from that. Who else did they have on the show?
Well, they had Buffalo Springfield on very, very early singing, you know, For What It's Worth, which is like a countercultural anthem.
Yep.
You know, something's happening here, and, you know, what it is ain't exactly clear. You know, you had they brought on Ravi Shankar, they had Jefferson Airplane, and my favorite is that after the Beatles had stopped touring, they had the Beatles on. I mean, exclusively, they had the Beatles in the U.S. premiere of the videos for Hey Jude and Revolution.
Now, that was very interesting because the Smothers Brothers were on CBS and the Beatles had started on CBS with Ed Sullivan, but they had chosen not Ed Sullivan to show this video, but the Smothers Brothers. Why?
Exactly right. And it's only 4 years later. I mean, the Beatles, you know, arguably owed their entire career, you know, globally to Ed Sullivan. And yet 4 years later, the Smothers Brothers and what they stood there, what they stood for in primetime was so different than the establishment that Ed Sullivan stood for that they wanted to throw their weight behind the Smothers. It's the best example that I can give to people who weren't there to see it at the time as to, you know, how divided the culture was and how the Smothers Brothers were on the right side.
And
as long as the Beatles are on your team, you're on the right side.
Which brings us to the evening of November 17th, 1968, when this aired on the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour.
Tommy also has a special guest, too, and he'd like to introduce him right now.
That's right, I have a Beatle.
Yeah, but it's not the kind of Beatle you would expect it to be. It's the kind of Beatle that you, I think you hoped it would be. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. George Harrison. Saw the several weeks ago we had on your people did
Hey Jude
and Revolution. Tommy and I both thought that Hey Jude was the best presentation that we've ever seen of the Beatles, and we're glad it was.
Yes,
on our
so
show.
We.
Did Matt Bond want to do?
This is Tommy, and this is my brother Dick.
Hi, Dick. Hi, Dick. Enjoyed your work. You look different in person.
Yeah, so do you. Yeah. It's all the makeup. Too much makeup.
Do you have something important?
Something very important to say on American television.
You know, we don't have opportunity of saying anything important because it's American television. Every time you say something They're trying to say something important. They clap, 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 clap.
Cue the lines. Well, whether you can say it or not, keep trying to say it.
That's what's important.
You get that? Yeah. That is very important. Cue. Just a minute.
Wait a second.
Okay. Cue the clap now.
There you go. George Harrison with Tom and Dick Smothers on the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, November of 1968. David Bianculli is the man behind the book, Dangerously Funny, the Uncensored Story of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. And there exactly is that connection you're talking about, David.
Yeah, it's amazing to me. They were thrown off the air like 3 months after getting a Beatle to come on unannounced as a surprise guest. It's astounding to me. And the studio audience is in full support and applauding the idea that you've got to fight your own network to try to say things.
Yeah.
So there's so much going on in that clip.
Now, the thing that maybe people don't know is that the Beatles and Smothers connection actually outlasted the Beatles because Tom was at the bed-in with John and Yoko.
Oh, yeah. Oh, not only that, but everybody knows Give Peace a Chance. But what I don't think many people know is that when that was recorded in that hotel room in Toronto, you know, everybody's talking about, it was Tommy playing one guitar right next to John Lennon playing the other. So, you know, Tommy Smothers was right there in the room, and he's actually name-checked in the lyrics. If you listen close, it's everybody's talking about, you know, Tommy Smothers is one of the names in there.
Wow. Tell me about the rivalry, if there was one, between the Smothers Brothers on CBS and George Slatter's Laugh-In on NBC.
It was actually a friendly rivalry at first because the two comedy teams really liked each other, Rowan and Martin and the two Smothers Brothers. And on the show that actually was never shown on CBS, Dan Rowan came on as a guest star to replace Dick, who wasn't in the show because he was off racing at Sebring. But Smothers Brothers paved the way for Laugh-In, but Laugh-In shot to the top and became more popular quickly and eclipsed it in terms of ratings by the end. And so NBC had more patience for what Laugh-In was doing than CBS did for what the Smothers were doing.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Did Tom and Dick kind of get jealous of the leniency that the network showed, that NBC showed towards Laugh-In when they were having all these problems with CBS?
They took some nice, good-natured shots in that penultimate show, the one that wasn't televised, where they even had a joke wall just the way Laugh-In had it, and they did a bunch of things, and then, you know, Tom and Dick said, well, this isn't funny. And he said, no, but it sure is popular. You know.
Last thing I got to ask you about is some of the people who later became huge stars who started out and got their TV starts from the Smothers Brothers. Name some of them.
Okay, well, in the writing room in season 3, there was Steve Martin and Rob Reiner. Mason Williams, who wrote Classical Gas, was a head writer and a big force in the whole show. There was Pat Paulson, who ran for president in 68. There was Bob Einstein, who went on to do Super Dave. Lee French, Share a Little Tea with Goldie. They sort of made big stars out of Glenn Campbell, John Hartford. The list really does go on and on.
It's a terrific book. I'm really enjoying reading it. I love the liner work that you did on the DVD, and I'm really enjoying the book now, David. It's called Dangerously Funny, the Uncensored Story of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. Thank you for all the years you put into this, and thanks for your few minutes here this afternoon.
Well, thanks so much. I love the few minutes, the many years. That was work.
David Bianculli here with Paul Harris on the Big 550 KTRS.